Okay, so we are starting the afternoon session with Diego Hoffman from Princeton University, who is going to tell us about the giant magnons.
Okay, well, thanks. I want to thank the organizers. I thought it would be a great chance to come here to Germany, celebrate the World Cup. Things didn't go as planned, but I'm happy to be here anyways. So, this one. Okay, so this is an outline of my talk. This is work I did with Juan Maldacena. I first I'll give a very short introduction to topics, maybe SEFT, spin chains, BMN, things we've been hearing about the last couple of days. I'm going to give a short idea of what this work is about. And then I'll discuss these giant magnon solutions in semi-classical string theory and what they're good for. I'll show some calculations of the S matrix, and I'll discuss some bound states. Then I'll finish with some further progress and conclusions. So, gauge theory, string theory, duality is it's an old idea. It's a very nice idea. The LHC is around the corner, so it's a good idea to think about these topics, wonder where you could maybe sometime build a gravity description of QCD. It's always good to keep the funding flowing in spite of LHC. All we have so far is string theory and ADS5 cross S5 duals to n equals 4 plus some other examples. We haven't built QCD yet, but we might get there. So in the very beginning, there were many objects that were studied in the concept of this duality. And but there are many problems and solutions. I mean, the basic feature is that this is a strong duality. And that makes it really interesting because it means that we might learn something about strongly coupled gauge theories by studying supergravity, for example. Or we can maybe define our string theories non-perturbatively by studying gauge theories. But it also makes it really difficult to study because, well, we can't expand around and see where we can match stuff. So BPS objects are very useful in this context, and they have been studied a lot. So I want to discuss some of those objects first. So BPS state is given by a trace of C to the J. C is a scalar. It's a complex scalar. Inside is the S. It's inside the SU4 and inside the sphere in the string theory, and it's a scalar charge. Charge under the SU4R symmetry. And this is a BPS state. It's delta is just J, and this is true for all values of the coupling. And it corresponds to a massless mode of 10-dimensional supergravity. This is just a point-like string going around the big circle in the S5. So that's good. We understand that. So what can we do next? So, my idea might be considering some impurity inside that long, well, in principle, if you think about this long chain of this long operator. And we can create this state by using a rotation operator on the old state. And this state is also BPS because it's always energy state with this new angular momenta, the one that the W is charged under. And it has a charge equals 1, and it's so this is always energy state of this kind. So it's also BPS. And once we've done that, go further. Say, okay, let's do what we always do. Let's give some this impurity some momentum. So you have this long chain of letters, and you have this impurity propagating along. The problem is that there's a catch, which is that gauge invariant operators have a trace in front of them, and the non-honest closed string state or gauge invariant operator, it's the same thing, ways of saying the same thing, should have at least two impurities, such that their momenta could cancel and give us zero total momentum. That's what we require. Those states are not BPS, but they're close and they have been studied. I'm going to talk about some. I'm going to say something about the BMN limit in a second. But this problem can be mapped to studying spin chain, where the conformal the anomalous dimension is mapped to the Hamiltonian of some spin chain, and the fundamental blocks will be these states where one impurity is propagating, remembering that the gauge invariant state is built with two of these states at the least. So the thing I want to consider is that I want to forget about these traits for a second and consider single excitations only propagating this long chain at infinite j. So it's a very long chain. And while we're going to study states, these states are, they turn out to be BPS. And they're quite interesting. One could wonder why is it okay to forget about the traits. And there's some good explanations, and for example, in the string theory side of the story, why forgetting about the traces is not that big a deal. But there are also good explanations in the gauge theory side of the story. So let me say something about the gauge theory side of the story. So at j going to infinity, this spin chain limit has been studied, and there's a dispersion relation of this form. This dispersion relation has been calculated, say, perturbatively in the gauge theory, where this is the effective coupling of the theory. So in perturbation theory, we can obtain the first few terms of this result. And also, some symmetry arguments, maybe by Bissert, allow us to actually get that exact formula that I just showed with the full square root. Now, I don't want to go into this discussion, but take me long, but this uses this SU2/2 cross SU2/2 symmetry, and the algebra gets extended when these states have are infinitely long and they don't have this trace on them. In a way, the operators that extend the algebra are some charges under which the gauge invariant operator should have zero charge, should be neutral. So these states we're going to consider are charged under these extensions of the algebra, and that'll be very useful to what we're going to study in a while. So, as I said, closed string states are neutral, it's the same as traced operators are neutral. And actually, the formula I showed is not, the symmetry argument just places an f of lambda here, not lambda over pi squared. So in principle, you could have a generic function of lambda. But it is true in the strong coupling regime that you obtain that function, and it's true to in perturbation theory in the gauge theory to a few orders that are compatible with that guess. So this is experimental physics in string theory. These are experimental results. F of lambda is just lambda over pi squared, and we'll take it to be that. So, in the string theory side, we can study a plane wave limit of these states, the BMN limit. And in that case, we will take j to infinity and lambda to infinity, holding p times j fixed. So in that possible, it is possible to actually quantize the theory exactly, and this was done by Bernstein, Malvin, and Anastasi, and this is the exact result for the spectrum of that theory. And you'll see that for very low momenta, this formula matches the previous formula I showed in the last transparency. So other tools that have been used are semi-classical strings. Those have been discussed yesterday and today. And the feature of these states is that they have large quantum numbers. So we'll discuss such a semi-classical state, and we'll see how we can match this to gauge theory. So the idea of this work is first to reproduce the full structure of the Magnum spectrum, and by that I mean that sign dependence over there that we could not see in the VMN limit. So that's one of the objectives, see if we can find that. And we're working in the large lambda limit, so we expect to find the formula of this form. This limit is definitely different from BMN, because here we're holding p fixed as we take j to infinity, and not p times j. And lambda in principle is free, and well, large lambda is going to tell us about string theory results, and small lambda is going to tell us about gauge theory results. We will also argue that the symmetries responsible for this formula are pretty much the same as the ones used in the gauge theory side of the story. One thing we can see that, for example, this SU2/2 cross SU2/2 has a bosonic subgroup that looks like SO4 cross SO4, and that's our symmetries in the string side of the story, where you have SO4 in the sphere and SO4 in ADS. So this looks like it might work. We'll discuss this in a minute. So the going through the objectives, the aim of this work. So we will identify the string states dual to the Magnum states in the spin chain, and using the solution, we'll calculate the S matrix semi-classically, and we'll see that we can match the FS formula. And we'll also say something about bound states. So let us start discussing a string with some localized excitations in flat space. This will be a good warm-up. So if we have a closed string in flat space with some localized excitations in the wall sheet. So I'm putting two excitations on the string, such that total momentum is zero. And this string maps, well, this string that has no excitations at all maps to a point. So all fields have the same value over the string, so they map to a single point in space-time. This is represented by this line. And here, when we have two excitations, this means that one side of the string gets mapped to a point, the other side of the string gets mapped to another point, and these excitations interpolate between these points. So this corresponds to, let's say, in principle, this could be a folded string, where part of the string is on one point, the other part is on the other point, and the middle is just the excitation interpolating between the two points. So this is what we see here. This state is massive, and this is in good agreement with this plot, where we see that overall the string is moving inside the light cone. So it's moving slightly, it's a smaller angle than the particle, than the Atlas particle. So this is another picture of the same state. So now what happens when we consider states with infinite length, such that the wall sheet is infinitely long? So in that case, the Virasoro constraints are not really telling us anything about the zero mode, about total p, because that loses its meaning for a very long string. So we can consider only one excitation in that case, and well, same picture as before is valid. So we have two points and the excitation interpolating between the two points, and this is a picture in space time. So we will look for such a solution in ADS 5 process 5, and that can be done by minimizing the string action. There's some other arguments. We'll see that these states are BPS, so they minimize the energy for such type of states. And by just working in conformal gauge, you can obtain these functional expressions for theta and phi, which parameterize an S2. We're just going to consider strings at this point in R cross S2. So these strings, I'll show you a picture in a minute, they look like this. So they're stretched in the S2, and they go to the equator. So this is pretty much the same picture as we see here. And this strings look rigid. They go around the sphere, but they don't change their shape. And so most of the string is concentrated on these points. That's what does the trick. If the string was not infinitely long, then this configuration would not be stable. Because most of the string is concentrated in these points are kind of heavy, they like to stay in the equator, and you can have the excitation interpolating, stretching between these two points. So let me go back to the formula. So in this formula, we'll see that while these configurations are static in the S2, this excitation, this excitation propagates in the wall sheet. And here's how we see that. They propagate with a velocity given by sine of theta zero. Theta zero is just the angle at which the string turns around. So this angle over here. So that's given by So that's given by this velocity. Now we're going to identify this velocity with the momentum we're looking for in the gauge theory side. So what will be true is that the angle subtended by this string is going to be identified by the momentum. So here we see in this formula P and delta phi. Delta phi is this angle. They're going to be identified. So how do we do that? Well, it turns out that in our gauge, our coordinate x is pretty much describing j, away from the excitation. The excitation we can consider small, and away from the excitation, our conformal gauge is telling us that E is constant, the density of energy is constant, but away from the excitation, the density of angular momentum is also constant. And this is what happens in a spin chain. In a spin chain, each side is occupied by one operator, and the density of angular momentum is constant. So these two variables can be identified except for a factor. And we can now study what's the velocity of this impurity in the gauge theory. It's given by the usual formula, and also by defining the canonical conjugate. This is the actual velocity from the initial dispersion relation that I showed you. And by calculating the velocity of the string, we'll see that this is just sine of theta 0, which is cosine of delta phi over 2, where delta phi is this angle. So we can identify these two numbers, these two variables, such that that our velocity is actually in this relation with the energy. So the velocity is given by the derivative of the energy with respect to momentum. So this is what I was telling you. We allow for an open string solution, and this is pretty much equivalent to relaxing the Virasoro constraints, which is the same as we did when we dropped the trace in the gauge theory. So now I'd like to describe this state in a slightly different coordinates. This will be useful to describe some of the algebra and to understand the state as BPS states. So LLM coordinates are just the coordinates used in the LLM paper. They're very useful. In this case, they just amount to a projection over the plane from DS2 to the plane. So this is how a magnon looks. It looks just like a straight line. So they're very simple solutions. And it turns out that in 10-dimensional supergravity, the anti-commutator of supercharges include gauge transformations of the B field. Those are the transformations that give the string their charge. So of course, strings are charged under the B field, and therefore, open strings that are stretched can be charged under this B field. Well, they are charged under this B field, but this is part of the algebra. And because that's part of the algebra, these states will be BPS. This line of reasoning is basically the same line of reasoning why strings stretched between D brains are BPS, because they're actually charged. They have a higher energy than non-stretched string, but that energy is given by a charge, by a winding charge. This is the same story here, where RP is going to be related to this charge under which that we can see as the stretching of the string in the circle. So these strings will be BPS. And, there's two winding charges because there's two directions in the sphere. So the winding charges are just the charge of the string under the B field, and that's just proportional to a length of the string. Let me go back up. So this length is just given by this formula. And this is just what we want. So our energy is going to be given by this kind of formula. With these things are the winding charges. And once we plug in the formula for the length of the string, we just get the usual dispersion relation. So this exact result can be obtained by the same symmetry arguments that were used in the gauge theory side by Weiser. And it's important to make a couple of comments here. This looks a little bit like 2 plus 1 Poincaré algebra. There's a subtlety, which is that boosts are not a symmetry of this theory. They're an automorphism, but they're not a symmetry. So this might look like a relativistic formula for the energy, but it's really not. It's just a BPS formula. It's just the usual BPS formula for states that have these two charges. So one more thing that I would like to say is that, of course, closed strings are not charged. So let's go back up. And we see that a closed string that goes round the circle still goes back to the starting point. So it has no net winding charges. And because they're not charged, these numbers are zero, and then these states cannot be BPS. Whatever energy they have does not come from these winding charges. So, they're not BPS in general, and that's why we're interested in this limit where J goes to infinity, and we can consider this open string state. So, so much for the algebra. So now that we've found the states, we would like to, and that we have identified the states with the Magnus states and the gauge theory side, we would like to make some semi-classical calculations on the S matrix and talk about some bound states. So sine Gordon model turns out to be very important in this case. Sine Gordon model is classically equivalent to the string moving in R cross S2. It's not a quantum equivalence, but it's classical at least. So this allows for a mapping between classical solutions of the string theory in R cross S2 and the sine Gordon model. And this will be useful for what follows, because it turns out that these magnons are just the usual sine Gordon solitons. If we go back and forth using the map, the sine Gordon solitons correspond to the string theory magnon. And the energy of these states is not the same. The actions of the two theories are different, and the energies are different. And it'll turn out that the energy in the string theory side will be inversely related to the energy of the sine Gordon model. And the Lorentz, we have a Lorentz symmetry in the sine Gordon model, and that allows us to boost our solution. And that's, symmetry will provide a one parameter family of solutions in string theory. That one parameter solution, that one parameter family of solutions is just given by the parameter p. So different solitons moving at different velocities correspond to strings with different momenta. So again, this symmetry is not a symmetry of string theory, it's just a symmetry of the sine Gordon theory. So again, this is a useful trick to calculate different states. Now that we've done this map and use it, we can then wonder about bound state solutions and scattering solutions. In the sine Gordon model, there are scattering solutions between these solitons, and it turns out that these scattering solutions map to scattering solutions in string theory, where we'll see excitations in the wall sheet going through each other and scattering afterwards. So because x and t, the variables we use, are the same in both model, the sine Gordon and the string theory model, we don't even have to do any calculations. We could, but we didn't even have to do it, because we just needed time delays, and these are the same as in the sine Gordon theory. So time delays are the same, but S matrices are not. This is very important. S matrix of the string theory is not the same as the S matrix of the sine Gordon model. And this is because, for example, one way to see this is in the WKV approximation, the phase of the S matrix can be calculated by this formula. And as you see, this has a derivative with respect to energy. And because the two theories have different energies, this will mean that the phases are not the same. So, we can do that for these states. We can consider either soliton-soliton scattering states or soliton-anti-soliton scattering states. The time delay is the same, so it doesn't really make a difference. The time delay is given by this formula, where this is just the usual gamma factors and this is the velocity of the excitation. And after integrating this formula, we just get this result, which agrees with the AFS formula, except for this term. So this is the usual AFS result, so it's very nice. We do a semi-classical calculation for large lambda, and we get the AFS result. But we still have this term to worry about, and this term turns out to be not to be that important. So there's some ambiguity here. The problem is the following. As I said, our gauge is chosen such that the density of energy is constant along the string. And that is true. But the density of J is only constant far away from the excitation, right? So in order to calculate velocities and all those quantities, we were not concerned by this. But the size of the excitation could be different in our variables than in the variables we usually use to describe gauge theory, where we have a spin chain and the density of J is pretty much constant everywhere, except where the exact perturbation is. And we well, at this order of approximation, we say that one size is not really important. So pretty much they have something like zero size, and ours have a big size. So we have to change coordinates such that we move from coordinates that have constant E everywhere to coordinates that have constant J. So the reason why this is going to solve our problem is the following. One way of thinking about it is looking at the Bethe-Ansatz equation. And in that case, you'll see that you have a factor that goes like e to the i t length. And if one, the problem is the following. If two solutions scatter off each other, the solutions coming from one side is going to see a larger distance because it has to go through the other soliton. So if the other soliton is very large, it has to go through a larger distance than in the gauge theory. So this is what we're actually trying to fix. And this difference in length will show up here in the face as a factor proportional to P, which is what we have here, right? Factor proportional to P plus a function of P, times a function of P. So it has to go like P times some function of P. So doing this change of coordinates, we do it like this, and we find that exactly the difference in length is given by a measure of length. It's just a measure of length in the gauge theory. This is the gauge theory, this is the string theory, minus contribution given by the density of energy. And this is, by the energy. And this is just what we have, right? We have just P times energy. So if we expect a mismatch given by P times delta length and the difference in length is just energy, then that's just what we needed to discard that term. So we actually have agreement once we switch coordinates to a meaningful frame. So to end the discussion about the scattering states, this is how they look in spacetime. They look like asymptotically like two magnons, one going above the equator, one going below, and they start shrinking. Of course, they're spinning around the sphere, and they start shrinking to zero size, and then they start opening up again to the back. So they look like two magnons when they go in, and they look like two magnons like when they go out, which is what we expect in the scattering experiment. So now, what about bound states? We know that the Sine-Gödel model has these breeder solutions. So the same way we treated this, we should expect to find new solutions in string theory by doing the map between this bound state solution, these breeder solutions, and string theory. So now there's a problem here. Inverting the map explicitly is not really easy. Once you find a solution in the Sine-Gödel model, it's not trivial to go to the string theory and write down your solution. If you can't write your solution, sometimes it's not very easy to calculate its energy, because classical energies are usually calculated using the solution. So it's not very clear how to write the energy of the solutions. For this case, it's a little bit easier. It's not easy to write the solutions explicitly, but it's very easy to actually check that the energy is just the sum of the energies without actually writing the solution. In this case, it's easy to do that for some particular cases of momentum and this internal degree of freedom Q. But integrability tells us that it should be reasonable to think of these states as given by their energy is given by the sum of the energies of these two states with complex momenta. Actually, these explicit solutions were obtained, and this is actually the case. I'll discuss this in a minute. So this is a problem of inversion, which is difficult in general. And we originally did this numerically, and we checked that for a huge range of variables, this is actually the case, that the energy of this bound state is just given by the sum of the energy of two magnons with complex momenta. So this is the energy of the state. As I said, it's just the sum of the energy. Now we plug in the complex momenta. And because these solutions are periodic, we can quantize them using some semi-classical approximation, and we can obtain this result over here. Now, this result is interesting. These bound states are interesting bound states. In principle, this is semi-classical quantization, so you should only trust this result for large n. One way of picturing these states is by thinking of a string wrapping sweeping the sphere, let's say, many times, and the velocity by which the string swaps the sphere is sweeps the sphere is given by the Zen higher excitation numbers. That's related to the Zen at least. Higher excitation numbers sweep the sphere faster. And well, these are not really. I mean, it's the word bound states. I mean, they come from Sine Gordon bound states, but they have definitely more energy than two separate magnets. And this happens again because the formula for the energy is different than the formula for the energy in the Sine Gordon case. So as I said, this is space-time picture. Well, this is a parameter that controls whether it actually sweeps the sphere or they're just oscillating in a small region of the sphere. So they look like this, or like this. Well, this one sweeps the sphere. And explicit solutions for this case were found in this paper by the dressing method. And we also obtained it at some point using some Backlund transformations obtained by Mikhailov. So by using these Backlund transformations, you can actually obtain these solutions explicitly. They don't look very illuminating, but at least that allows for a computation of the energy. So what about? I mean, these bounces look kind of weird because they're actually heavier than two magnons. So at least for large n. So you might wonder whether these particles are real particles. We should actually consider them or not. Maybe they can decay. But if you really believe the system is integrable, you have to live with these bound states because these bound states cannot decay. Where are they going to go? I mean, they're made of two magnons with complex p, and then you know p has to remain the same, p has to be conserved. So they have pretty much nowhere to go. They're just magnons with complex p, and p cannot change, right? So in any interaction, there's no way for these guys to decay. So they should be stable. If they are there, well, they are honest states that you can scatter as well, and also they should, in principle, appear as poles in the S matrix. So this interesting work. We're actually working on this right now, and other things. There's a subtlety here. It's related to it's not a subtlety. It's actually an important fact, I would say. That these states are very clear what they are in the string theory picture. So for large lambda, they're definitely there, at least for large n. And it's not clear what they are in the gauge theory side. So there's two ways of thinking about this. You either find them in the gauge theory side, you either figure out what they are in the gauge theory side, or maybe they're not there in the gauge theory side. If they're not there in the gauge theory side, then we could be witnessing a similar phenomenon to the one Igor discussed yesterday, where, you know, suddenly states, there's a phase transition of some kind, new states appear. This is very similar to the case where you have this quark potential, and these excitations appear only for large lambda but not for small lambda. So you either make sense of these states in the gauge theory, or if they're not there, then there's a possibility that they appear at some finite value of lambda. This is a strange phenomenon because there's an infinite number of these states, so it's kind of different to the behavior you find in Sine Gordon theory, where bound states start going in one by one as you move the coupling. In this case, there's an infinite number of them, and it's very likely that it will appear all at once at some point, some value for lambda. So I think these bound states are very interesting and are important to understand in order to understand the S matrix phase factor. So after this paper came out, there has been further progress in this field. Some BPS bound states were found, and he says the one under the square root formula, because this formula for magnet was generalized to a second angular momentum where you can actually find the one under the square root that we were not considering, that we were missing. So there's some discussion about this one and whether these are elementary excitations or not. We certainly think that maybe quantizing this theory, you can also find the one from any magnet solution. But this is certainly useful to actually have found a classical state that actually has the good dispersion relations. So this is actually important to match to the gauge theory. Other developments were, well, studies of finite size effects. I won't discuss much of this because some of these topics are going to be discussed further on. And there were well, analysis of classical solutions, similar limits, magnons in beta deformed backgrounds, and also multi-spin solutions were constructed with three different spins for angular momentum. So what are the conclusions for this work? Well, first and most importantly, fundamental excitations have been identified on both sides of the correspondence. So now we know what the building blocks of the theories are on both sides, and we know what, well, how to do scattering experiments like the one I consider today. Also, the symmetries responsible for the spectrum were matched. We, of course, found the same spectrum on both sides. These states are BPS, so they have the same spectrum at all values of the coupling. And the symmetries responsible for this spectrum were actually matched on both sides of the story, where these central charges in the gauge theory side appear as these winding charges in the string theory side. Also, we calculated this matrix, and well, we found agreement with the FS formula after redefining length. But this is also a very non-trivial check of the AF formula that was obtained using the different results, different methods. And well, we obtained this bound state spectrum, and I already discussed this problem with the coupling dependence. And well, as they should appear as poles in the S matrix. So this is actually very interesting. We're looking into this, and this could actually tell us something more about the S matrix, help us find its phase factor. So some future directions are further investigation of the S matrix for more general bound states, so not just magnons, but bound states of magnons of this kind or BPS magnons. And well, this is actually in progress. And of course, the final objective is trying to pin down this phase factor. And well, for that, for this crossing symmetry to study, these poles I've discussed and the pole structure of the S matrix. And well, we're going to hear more about this further on. So I guess I'll stop here. Thank you.
We have plenty of time for questions, so please go on.
Sorry? Yeah, dispersion relation.
Looks like there's a bound state of M magnet.
Right.
What are you saying in terms of the
I'm saying that those states are heavier than actual magnets. So they're heavier than two different magnets, two free magnets, right? So
when you
yeah, I'll show the formula. Yeah, that's a good idea. Okay, so that's the formula you're talking about, right? Yeah, there's a coefficient 4. Yeah, that's crucial. Yes, that's crucial. That's actually crucial. Actually, there's an interesting comment here. Let's say, in order to obtain the you can study gauge theory, for example, by using the Haber model. And the Haber model magnons come as bound states of half excitations in the Haber model. And well, you can make a bound state, you quantize them. And if you follow that calculation for large J, and you compare it to this calculation, you see that the calculation is pretty much the same. The only difference are half excitations here are magnons, and so we get a state that's heavier than an actual magnon. It has twice the mass, but that M squared parameter. So one idea I entertained for some time is, well, if you could find half excitations on the string theory side, you did the exact same thing, you would obtain the exact 1 plus lambda squared over pi squared, lambda over pi squared sine squared formula. Of course, you don't expect to find these half excitations on the string theory side. It's not clear what they mean, if they mean anything at all. But it is interesting that the formulas you go through to obtain this formula over here are pretty much the same as the formulas you go through when you make these bound states in the Haber model. For large J, there's some exponential correction, but for large J, it's the same set of formulas. So.
Yeah, just a comment. I think you can in Haber model, when you make these bound states out of two fermions, mm-hmm. to get one magnon, you can have the case when the rapidity of the magnon is real, but also you can have the case when the rapidity of the magnon is complex, so you can make bound states of this magnon. So I think they resemble a little
but
bit to the...
Aren't they going to have less energy than... So you think you can build states that have higher energy than the
you can build
magnon.
States from magnons with imaginary momentum, and I think the mechanism is essentially the same.
It'd be interesting to see.
So more.
Yes.
What are the flavors of the giant magnets?
So this excitation, this. Let's say we take these solutions that are spinning, that have this extra angular momentum. Let's think of those for a minute. So this giant magnets always stretch on S2, but then they have eight bosonic directions where this extra arrow could be pointing, right? So they always stretch on S2, but you have eight transversal directions where you can put the excitation, plus the eight fermionic directions. The magnets that are also spinning, that is. Yes. No, they're free. Yeah. You can calculate fluctuations on this giant magnet solution. They propagate as free particles. So there's.
So more questions?
I think it was on page 12.
Page 12, okay. Good memory, I have no idea.
It was 13,
good.
Sorry. It's 13, actually, sorry.
Oh, okay.
So I'm slightly confused, because I thought you said that this picture here, that this was actually the bound.
This one?
Yeah.
This is not the bound, this is a scattering state.
That's...
So, see, initially it looks like two magnets, one going above the equator, one going below. Yeah. And then this string starts shrinking to a point. As it moves around the S5, it starts shrinking. The front part of the string goes back. Because the two points are not the same. The point in the back, let's say there are two points that cross the equator. The point in the back is infinitely heavy, it has infinite J. Yeah. The other one doesn't. It does asymptotically, but it doesn't. It's like a pendulum falling from the top, right?
Okay.
So it starts falling, it shrinks to a point, and then it starts inflating on the back. So it looks like two magnets going in and like two magnets going out.
Right.
And they interact in the middle.
Okay. Yeah, why is it closed? But it's not really closed, is what you're saying.
Well, it's a closed string because this picture is a picture of two magnets with the same momenta. So because they have the same momenta, it means that the total momentum of the scattering configuration is zero. And that means that it's a closed string. Well, then the two points in the back, they're actually not at the same point. They're actually maybe. They should look like. I don't know if you can see this. Something like this. Can you see this? So this thing is given by the difference in momentum. So these are the scattering states, not the bound states. Well, this is for soliton-soliton scattering. For soliton-anti-soliton scattering, they're on the same side. And then something more strange happens, which is this endpoint detaches from the equator and goes back. So the picture is something like this. So this is the heavy point. And after a while, it goes like this. So it looks like two magnets. This is like a folded string. It's a folded flow strain. It looks like two magnets going in and two magnets going out. This is related to the point in S3 that you choose, right, for these magnets. Because these are in S2, so you have to keep them point in S3, so the two hemispheres are points in S3. This one. Yes. Yes. That's the problem. Yes. Yes. You don't expect these states to be BPS, so they should receive corrections. At large N, maybe you can say something about that. I don't know. It's not clear what they are in the gauge theory. Where they are, there at all. It'd be good if we could find them, if we could actually explicitly find them. What would you say? Oh, because of the correction? Oh, okay. No, I would expect this to change a finite lambda. There what? No, probably. I mean, if this formula is true, at least for large N, not for small, but for large N, you should trust all your states, right? That is true, but. Then I would expect some corrections that would change the masses, but I guess I would. If that's the case, that would be very bad news. But as long as you can, you have to figure out what they are for smaller lambda, yes. But if you don't, then that might be the case. It's a very similar phenomenon to the one Igor discussed yesterday. I agree. You're right. Yes, I understand that at infinite lambda you could have infinite, but then as you go back, you might have finite numbers. I would expect that for large lambda, this semi-classical results should still be valid, even for finite lambda. Not that infinite lambda, but because I can still trust this supergravity approximation for large lambda. So I would expect them to be there for very large lambda, even if it's not infinite lambda, right? If it's not formally infinite, because I would still trust this description. So that would mean that there's actually an infinite number of them, even at large finite lambda, and that makes it complicated. Right. Sorry, I didn't get that. Right. So you. No, that's the point. That doesn't look very good. I agree. It doesn't look very good. Yes.
Everywhere.
Right. No, I agree. It's not a nice picture. If that's the case, it's not a nice picture. That's why I think it's important to make sense out of these states. What are they actually doing, and where you can identify them?
But actually, if you then the other possibility would be to have a finite number of poles disappearing as you turn the coupling smaller. But then again, how can you have whole drop one by one from this thing, like just in a coupling. I don't see how you can actually have holes disappearing with this. But
right, that's the point. It's difficult to make them disappear by one by one. So that's why it seems like a. Yes.
Yeah. Maybe. Oh, so. Maybe we can leave the further questions for discussions and move to the next speaker.
Thank you.
Just first thank to Diego.